When it comes to the Ukrainian conflict, it has not subsided in any shape or form. The situation is becoming more dire and dangerous. More dangerous since the way Russia sees it, the West's excessive push to arm Ukraine is fueling the conflict, possibly edging closer to a World War III scenario. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at why the U.S. is so keen to focus only on arming Ukraine and defeating Russia, but not on ending the war and saving lives.
Russia's tensions with the West are threatening to quickly spiral out of control as the war in Ukraine drags on. Immediately after the start of the conflict on February 24th, the U.S. and its allies rushed to the aid of Ukraine. They've imposed sweeping sanctions against Moscow and provided Kiev with military and humanitarian assistance. The size of those shipments and sophistications of the weaponry have been increasingly growing. Besides that, U.S. State and Defense Secretaries recently traveled to Ukraine, promising more military aid.
They need long-range fires. You've heard them express a need for tanks. And we are doing everything that we can to get them the types of support, the types of artillery and munitions that will be effective in this stage of the fight. We're going to push as hard as we can, as quickly as we can, to get them what they need.
What I'm seeing, at least, is that aid is getting here and other distribution points. It's getting out the door incredibly quickly.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is the latest U.S. official to travel to Kiev. There, she promised Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky that more help is on the way. Pelosi was referring to a request by President Joe Biden from Congress to pass an aid package to Ukraine. The package is worth $33 billion, with almost two-thirds of it allocated to military aid. That aid includes everything from heavy artillery and armored vehicles to greater intelligence sharing, cyber warfare tools, as well as anti-tank and anti-aircraft missiles. Meanwhile, French President Emmanuel Macron, in a phone call with Zelensky, said Paris would step up military and humanitarian support to Ukraine. Those measures by the U.S. and its allies have prompted strong warnings and criticism from Moscow. Russia says the military aid is not only fueling the conflict, but also boosting the risk of direct confrontation between Russia and NATO powers.
The tendency itself to pump weapons, including heavy weapons, to Ukraine and other countries is an action that threatens the security of the continent and provokes instability.
Yet more starkly, the Russian foreign minister has warned that the conflict in Ukraine risks escalating into a third world war. Sergei Lavrov says NATO is in essence engaged in a proxy war with Moscow by supplying Kiev with weapons. He has urged the U.S. and NATO to stop sending weapons if they really want to resolve the Ukraine crisis. On the ground in Ukraine, Russia has been targeting foreign weapons. In the latest such move, Moscow says it struck weapons shipments supplied by the U.S. and European countries on an airfield near the southern port city of Odessa. In another sign of escalation, Moscow says dialogue between Russia and the U.S. on strategic stability has been formally frozen. And so as Russia's warnings go unheeded in the West, there's a real risk that the war will spill across Ukraine's borders before it comes to a peaceful resolution inside.
Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Ian Williams, president of the Foreign Press Association of the U.S., joins us from New York. Also joining us is Marcus Papadopoulos, author, historian, and political analyst, who joins us from London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Marcus Papadopoulos, I'll start with you. Looking at the most recent development that is of significance is what happened on the ground with the Russian strikes that hit a U.S. weapons, depot at an airfield near Odessa. The Russian Defense Ministry said that this was a military airfield, and it destroyed a runway and a hangar containing the Western-supplied weapons and ammunition. To me, that sounds like progress on the Russian side.
Well, the response of the West to the Russian military campaign in Ukraine is not only about trying to deprive Russia of Ukraine, but it is also centered on the Western ruling elites attempting to preserve the global order which they established some 30 years ago following the demise of Soviet communism and the dissolution of the USSR. So on the one hand, by the West flooding Ukraine with all sorts of weaponry, the Western ruling elites are hoping to inflict a military defeat on the Russian army, which I should say is both fanciful and also exceedingly dangerous for global peace and global stability. And on the other hand, the Western ruling elites are trying now to preserve the global order, which has been in existence for three decades now, because the Western ruling elites, specifically Washington and London, are acutely aware that because of their stance on Russia, because of the sanctions they have imposed on Russia, Beijing and Moscow have become even closer. Uh-huh. And it is abundantly clear that Russia and China are now intent on dismantling the global order which the West created 30 years ago. And as regards the military situation in Ukraine, well, the Ukrainian armed forces are virtually paralyzed as a result of potent Russian military strikes on them. Furthermore, the Russians are now systematically destroying the logistics chain of the Ukrainian armed forces, which means the Ukrainian armed forces in eastern Ukraine and in southern Ukraine will not be able to be replenished with soldiers and weaponry.
Okay. Ian Williams, it doesn't sound like you agreed with anything our guests are said from London.
It's like Alice in Wonderland, everything through a looking glass. First of all, may I wish you a happy May Day, comrades all over the world. And just to get over the binary politics, I should remind you that May Day started in Chicago. It was an American holiday. It's celebrated all the world over, usually by workers parading, not by military oligarchs and dictators parading their troops in the Kremlin or Red Square or anywhere else. So having got that ritual greeting out of the way, I'd point out, who are the biggest importers of weapons into Ukraine? The Russian army brought billions of dollars worth of high-technology weapons into Ukraine. No one asked them to. They brought them for free. They've been told to take them out. Oh, they want negotiations. Anytime they want peace, all they have to do is to obey international law, obey the strictures of the International Court of Justice, listen to what the rest of the world is saying, and get their troops out of there. That's all they need for peace. That's all you need. So when a bully punches someone in the face and friends come and aid the victim, oh, this is aggression. This is aggression. Let's get the perspective. It is Russian weapons, which the Ukrainians are using mostly, by the way. Most of the Ukrainian weapons supply is ex-Soviet or Russian that they bought recently from Russia. The Russian weapons is drying up. The rosy military situation that Comrade Papadopoulos talked about is not nearly as rosy. They stopped making the weapons because they relied on imported Western components, because Putin had concentrated so much on military hardware and turning the place into a failed third world petrostate, he neglected the industry. Now, he was aided in this with Western neoliberal economists who really trashed his economy for it. But he and his oligarchs were willing accomplices on this, as long as they got the money and took enough for the army. So, you know, there's plenty of blame to go around here. But the essence of it is international law, as Guterres said, the Guterres who went on a peacemaking mission, the Secretary General of the United Nations, and the Russians shelled and bombed the city that he was visiting. How is that for a gesture of peace? How is that for a gesture of good intentions? These are not equivalents. We have a brutal, rapacious dictator who has invaded another country.
Sure, let's get
into another country with loads of weapons and is not destroying logistics. He's destroying cities. He's destroying apartment blocks.
Marcus,
he's blowing up hospitals.
Let's get Marcus's response here.
This is not countenanceable by any civilized measure.
The diverging views, Marcus Papadopoulos, is very evident, because I think the U.S. is calling it diabolical when they describe Putin in some sense. And I use that because Nancy Pelosi, the U.S. House Speaker, visited Ukraine very recently. I mean, first of all, why would she visit Ukraine? I mean, I think she could have done a Skype with Zelensky to show her support, but she had to somehow make sure that she was present there. Why do you think that was? The only reason I could think of here is that she wanted to make sure that, aside from, sympathize with him and show solidarity, to make sure that Zelensky actually is continuing the war. I mean, what other reasons would she have?
Well, I think there are a number of factors, one of them being that politicians in, for example, America, sense an opportunity to make a name for themselves. We have to remember that the caliber of politicians in the United States is atrociously low. So people such as Pelosi are hoping to enter the textbooks of history as being the ones who played a vital role in the defeat of the Russian army and in the subsequent downfall of Vladimir Putin. But at the same time, the Americans understand in private that the Russians are winning the war in Ukraine. They understand that the Ukraine which existed prior to the 24th of February 2022 will never ever return. They understand that a new and enlarged Russian state is in the making. So by visiting Kiev, Pelosi and other American politicians are attempting to bolster the morale of the Ukrainian ruling elite and of the Ukrainian armed forces, together with the morale of Ukrainian paramilitaries, at what is a perilous time for them. And as regards to the origins of the Russian military campaign in Ukraine, we have to be mindful that for 30 years, beginning in 1992, following the dissolution of the Soviet Union, Moscow asked, told, warned America not to extend its tentacles to Ukraine, because Ukraine is of vital importance to Russian national security and is absolutely imperative to the Russian national identity. If Russia was to extend its tentacles to Canada and Mexico, I would thoroughly condemn that. Why? Because it would be dangerous for global peace and global security.
Sure. Ian Williams, would you like to respond?
This concept has been used by other people. The last person to use it called it Lebensraum. He said the Germans had a destiny to take over their neighbours. This is what we have here. We have Russisch Lebensraum. We have the Russians saying that they have a manifest destiny. This is a bit like Britain saying, we owned Ireland for 800 years. It's ours, really. We go back in and get it any time. This type of atavistic empire building from the Slavic swamps. You remember, the Russian state was actually born in Ukraine. If anything, the Ukrainians should be taking over Moscow, which was a Mongol-ruled swamp when Russia, when the Rus was a pinnacle of civilization on the steppes there. This is atavistic, proves nothing at all. This is an evocation of history to promote Lebensraum. It's a bit like the Zionist claim to Israel. Our ancestors may have been there 3,000 years ago, so we can go and take it now and heaven help the people who are in it. It's got no relation. Now, on the case of Pelosi, I haven't got much time for Pelosi or American politicians, but I will say Pelosi and Biden and Angelina Jolie have actually gone into war zones to show their support. Vladimir Putin would only meet the Secretary General of the United Nations across a table the length of a football pitch because he's so scared that someone is going to poison him. And why is he so scared they're going to poison him? Because his laboratories, his FSB and his people are providing the wherewithal to do so and have done so to the opposition at home and abroad. This is, you know, we're in, an Alice in Wonderland world.
All right.
No time for Pelosi and the general principles, but I admire it.
Before you jump in, Marcus Papadopoulos and Ian Williams, both of you, I'd like to first thank for not interrupting each other while you were speaking, though you both disagree. But I'd like to ask both, if you'd like, you can jump in so we can make this more lively. And I say that because, in essence, we're running out of time. So, Marcus Papadopoulos, go ahead. But, of course, let's try to do it so that we can understand what each other is saying. Go ahead, Marcus.
Indeed. I abhor all forms of racism. And what I heard just now from the guest in New York was racism towards Russians. Referring to Russia as a swamp is absolutely disgusting. I would also like to say this as well. Would you not interrupt me? Democracy is partly about respecting other people's opinions and allowing other people to speak. Now, in regard to the significance of Ukraine to Russia, if the gentleman in New York is so very au fait with the history of both Russia and Ukraine, then perhaps he can explain to me and to our audience the significance of 1654, the Treaty of Pereyaslav, and Bogdan Khmelnytsky. I suspect he will have great difficulties in being able to do that. The truth of the matter is that with the exception of the westernmost parts of Ukraine, namely Ternopil, Lvov, Ivano-Frankivsk, Rivne, and Volyn, the rest of Ukraine is directly linked to Russia and the Russian people. They are the same people. Russians, Belarusians, and Ukrainians are East Slavs. Much of the Ukrainian population are members of the Moscow Patriarchate. Again, you are interrupting me. You are not being respectful. I have responded to what you said, and now I will give way to you. That is partly what democracy is about.
Ian Williams, go ahead.
Excuse me, I've got... The moderator said we should cut in with each other. I am very sorry, Marco, on this, but I kept my quiet. But when you come out with absolute rubbish, I do have to contradict and get in there.
Well,
what
that's
have you done for Russia?
I got to jump in here. I'm sorry, Ian Williams. When you say that, that's kind of what Lloyd Austin said, and many are critiquing him for saying that, in a sense, because it kind of parallels what you said, in which he said the U.S. goal in this war is to weaken Russia over the long term. And some are saying that, the U.S. then lied, because that's not what it said in the beginning. In the beginning, it wanted to end what it called an insurgency that was going on. And then it went on to say there should be some peace efforts to happen. But now it has come out and said, no, our aim is to weaken Russia.
It's the U.S. that's weakened Russia. It's Putin.
Well, Marcus Papadopoulos, let me ask Marcus to jump in. Marcus Papadopoulos,
Putin managed to rip up the guarantees.
You had the U.S. Secretary of Defense, as they call it, Lloyd Austin, in that after the meeting that happened in Germany, where U.S. invited 40 countries, it said something that was very, in some ways, eye-opening, promising to move heaven and earth to ensure Ukraine's victory in the war. Now, we know that Secretary Lloyd Austin was immediately, after retiring from CENTCOM, to have joined the board of Raytheon Technologies. But aside from that...
whose shares have dropped, by the way, because they were selling to Russia, and those sales have been stopped by the sanctions.
How is that for capitalism? What does that show when you have the U.S. Secretary of, as they call it, defense, make a statement like that, which squarely falls to a military solution, which goes hand-in-hand with the U.S. goal to weaken Russia?
And Putin isn't threatening.
That's Marcus Papadopoulos. I'm sorry, Ian Williams. Marcus Papadopoulos, go ahead.
Well, first of all, the Soviet economy, which by the time of the dissolution of the USSR was the second largest in the world, was actually destroyed by the pro-Western agenda of Mikhail Gorbachev and Boris Yeltsin. It had nothing to do and with Putin. Vladimir Putin. I would also add that the gentleman in New York's knowledge of Soviet history and Russian history is not just lamentable, but it is also laughable. Now, turning to the American Defense Secretary's remarks, the Americans are attempting to inflict a military defeat on the Russian army with the knowledge that if Russia was to lose in Ukraine, and if Ukraine was to remain in the West's sphere of influence and one day join NATO, then Russia could never hope to be the superpower that it was in Soviet times. Ukraine is absolutely imperative to Russia, not just in terms of Russian national security, but also in terms of Russian global power as a whole. So the Americans
want the jewel of the crown of the British Ukrainian armed forces
to try and defeat the Russian military.
So now I got to jump in now and give because we're almost out of time, Ian Williams, 30 seconds to you. I'm sorry, Marcus. Ian Williams, 30 seconds. Are we looking at this conflict to have gone global? Marcus, go ahead.
Let me say, the Americans are also making a racket by supplying the Saudi Arabian military with so much weaponry that the Saudis have killed some 200,000 Yemeni men, women, and children. The Americans do not care about humanity.
I'm sorry, gentlemen. We are out of time. I'm sorry about that. We're fresh out of time. Thank you. Ian Williams, president of the Foreign Press Association of the U.S. Marcus Papadopoulos, thank you. Author, historian, political analyst. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitavli, it's goodbye.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Dear listeners, hello everyone. Welcome to another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and in this edition, we will try to have a closer look at the 25th chapter, Surah Al-Furqan. First, let's just listen to the verses we're going to talk about in this program, and we'll be back shortly. So stay with us.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
وهو الذي خلق من الماء بشرا فجعله نسبا وصهرا وَكَانَ رَبُّكَ قَدِيرًا.
And it is He who has created from semen a human being and made him a relative by lineage and marriage. And ever is your Lord competent concerning creation.
We are going to discuss the 54th verse of this chapter. وَهُوَ الَّذِي خَلَقَ مِنَ الْمَاءِ بَشَرًا فَجَعَلَهُ نَسَبًا وَصِهْرًا وَكَانَ رَبُّكَ قَدِيرًا. And He it is who has created man from water. Then He made him related in blood and in wedlock. And your Lord is ever powerful. Since the previous verses talked about the falling of rain as well as the locating of the salty and sweet waters beside each other, now this verse mentions the creation of man from water. But the purpose of water in this noble verse is the sperm of man, and the evidence of it is found in the following two verses that says, "Did we not create you from a base fluid, and He is created from a gushing fluid?" Anyway, the verse starts saying, وَهُوَ الَّذِي خَلَقَ مِنَ الْمَاءِ بَشَرًا, and He it is who has created man from water. Verily, carving on water and shaping such a novel figure on water is the reason for the omnipotence of Allah. In fact, the former verses talked about the growth of plants because of rainwater, the different benefits of rainwater. But here it speaks about a higher level, that is the creation of something, which is man, of utmost complexity from water. Therefore, the commentators believe that the purpose of water here is the sperm from which all men are generated by Allah's might. And this sperm, which is floating in water, joins the woman's, and the first blossom of man's life, that is the first living cell of man, will be created.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine.
In this series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
If a man carefully studies the various phases of forming sperm, from the beginning up to the end of the fetal period, he sees a lot of signs of Allah's might and magnificence, so that they will be enough to know His pure essence, His existence in the world. And this commentary about translating the purpose of water into the sperm of man will be proved by the sentences that follow the verse, and we will, God willing, explain it.
Anyway, undoubtedly, most of man's body consists of water. Talking about benefits of water, we can mention that the main material of every man is water. And consequently, man can very scarcely resist lack of water. While he can survive many days and weeks without eating food, but he cannot resist a lack of water. He cannot resist thirst. Of course, it is possible that all of these meanings are included in the concept of the verse. I mean, the reason why the word water is mentioned in this verse could be both the first man is created from water and all human beings that are created from water, which was sperm. And that water is the most important material of man's body. But what amazes us is the fact that water is the simplest material of the world. You see it everywhere, but how has it become the source of such wonderful creation? This is the reason for his might. This is what he wants us to consider and understand. وَهُوَ الَّذِي خَلَقَ مِنَ الْمَاءِ بَشَرًا And he it is who made man from water. And then the verse continues after mentioning the creation of man to talk about the increase of generations. It says, فَجَعَلَهُ نَصَبًا وَصِهْرًا And then he made him related in blood and wedlock. The purpose of the word nasab or blood is the relationship that is between men by way of reproductions and births, such as the relationship between father and offspring or relationship between brothers. The word sihr, the purpose of this word or translated into wedlock, originally means groom. And the purpose of this word, which is used in this verse, is the relationship that occurs through marriage between the two families, such as the relation of man with the close relatives of his wife, which is created in this way. These two are what Islamic jurists say as the indirect cause and lineage in the subject of marriage. Brothers and sisters, we will, God willing, talk about this verse more in the next episode. Thank you for staying with us. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me, worry, and that's when faith begins.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Eruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
For the first time since the presidential election, the Yellow Vests marched around the country, and most expressed disbelief that Emmanuel Macron was re-elected despite his unprecedented repression of the group.
Frankly, we really don't understand how Macron could be re-elected. We started over purchasing power, and it's worse than ever. I guess people need a knife to their throats to come protest anymore?
They were met by a huge police presence, armed to the teeth. The government continues to intimidate Yellow Vests, but also the average person from rejoining the demonstrations. Intimidating deterrence is also being used to keep journalists from covering the group. In the Yellow Vest demonstration the day before the first round of voting, a journalist from a top French media was fined for allegedly illegally demonstrating while simply reporting on the Yellow Vests.
We'll never stop demanding for citizens' referendums, purchasing power, decent pensions, and the ability to have some money left at the end of the month. After the legislative elections in June and the summer vacation, social unrest will explode this fall.
Thousands of devoted Yellow Vests will continue to turn out every Saturday in Paris alone, and they say others will put their Yellow Vests back on when they see Macron's plans for his second term.
Emmanuel Macron will continue to be the president of the rich and will continue to march. People will eventually recover their good sense and realize the only way to change politics is to join us in the streets.
Nobody expected the Yellow Vests to stop marching. Now we'll see if they can last for the next 5 years. Global May Day protests will see establishment forces, such as unions and political parties, march nationwide in favor of workers' rights, but also to express major dissatisfaction with the presidential election. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
As the month of Ramadan is coming to an end, Muslims are gearing up to pick the best clothes to get dressed up for one of their biggest festivities, Eid al-Fitr, or the Festival of Breakfast. This exhibition gives a glimpse of local costumes of several Muslim countries, from Tunisia and Egypt all the way to Afghanistan and Iran.
On Eid al-Fitr and other important festivities in Tunisia, men wear this white costume and women dress like me or the clothes that you see behind me. They are our traditional clothes.
The shirt this man is wearing is made from a Syrian cloth called the maska. It's a famous Syrian cloth that's made out of silk and cotton. Syrian men wear them in celebrations such as weddings and also during our festivities such as Eid al-Fitr.
Aside from showcasing their costumes, the participating nations also get to introduce their Ramadan traditions and what they have for iftar breakfast.
In Syria, it's customary to break a Ramadan fast with our traditional appetizers such as fattoush and tabbouleh. In my city, Aleppo, we start with dairy such as hot milk. Afterwards, we eat the main dish, which varies from a city to the other.
In Afghanistan, we cook our delicious gulani and ashak for Ramadan breakfast. These foods actually are cooked for our dearest guests in other months of the year.
Organized jointly by Iran's Echo Office and the Culture Ministry, the event seeks to bring about a stronger bond between Muslim nations by sharing their cultures and traditions.
Here, Muslims get together to find their commonalities and at the same time learn about their differences. The expo also brought exhibitors coming from ECO member states. The reason we held it in the holy month of Ramadan is to say that despite all our differences, all of us are Muslims and need to unite.
Muslims say Ramadan brings them together more than any other time, since they all practice the same religious tasks throughout the month. And as the call to prayers resonated in the exhibition, all fasting Muslims left the expo for a shared iftar breakfast.
Despite all the differences in languages, costumes, and even Ramadan meals, people here say they feel like they're one nation, since they all come from Muslim countries. And organizers say this is what Ramadan offers, a taste of peace and friendship that transcends all differences. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Afghanistan, once again facing waves of deadly attacks. In the latest incident, a powerful explosion hit Khalifa Sahib Mosque in the capital Kabul, killing and injuring dozens of worshippers.
Every Friday, people come to the mosque to say their prayers. Hearing the bomb explosion, I entered the mosque. I am shocked as I'm talking. We took more than 200 casualties to the hospital. It was so horrifying that I had never witnessed such a scene.
Previously, we were falling victim to the US and Taliban war. However, the situation has now changed, but we're still being killed in the mosques and schools. We don't know who are carrying out such blind attacks, but I'm sure the attackers are not Muslims.
Exhausted by growing violence, people of Afghanistan are calling for an end to terror attacks and punishment for the perpetrators.
In my opinion, the recent attacks on specific groups and places show that the enemies of the people of Afghanistan are trying to sow sedition among Muslims and impose another proxy war on Afghans. The Taliban, as new rulers, are obliged to protect Afghans and bring the terrorists to justice.
The international community should take action in ending violence in Afghanistan. They know the roots of terrorist groups or criminal bonds. They should help Afghans with practicing stability. If they are voicing human rights, so why they are watching us falling victim to terrorism?
In the recent days, several large bomb attacks targeted public places in the capital Kabul, Mazar-i-Sharif and Kunduz provinces. The attacks have taken a scores of lives, mostly from the Hazara community. Bomb attacks in Afghanistan continue as Afghans are observing the holy month of Ramadan. People here believe their enemies are missing no chance to harm innocent Muslims. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
This iftar table stretches for 5 kilometers. Organized by Tehran's Grand Bazaar, the event served iftar to over 5,000 people. Mostly low-income families. Organizers say it is the longest iftar spread ever hosted in the world.
I'm honored to have the chance to host my fellow citizens for an iftar dinner. The Grand Bazaar of Tehran started this initiative with the aim of helping the less privileged. Throughout the year, we launch many charity initiatives, but its climax is in Ramadan, because it is the month of kindness.
This is the second time Tehran's Grand Bazaar hosts such a large-scale iftar meal as a charity gesture. The benefactors who contributed to the event say Ramadan is a time to push the limits on humanity and put a smile on the faces of the needy.
It's so beautiful when you see the rich and the poor sit around the same iftar spread and break their Ramadan fast. I'm so happy to be a part of this, and I hope such humanitarian gestures will be promoted to hopefully root out poverty.
Every year in Ramadan, charity works get supercharged, with Muslims trying to pitch in to have a say in helping the poor, as they believe Ramadan is not just about abstention from eating and drinking, but it's a time for sharing love and kindness with fellow human beings.
With all its beautiful celebrations like this large iftar party, Ramadan is about to come to an end. But organizers say what's important is to learn the lessons of Ramadan on the beauty of kindness and togetherness, which if practiced, the world would be a better place to live. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Palestinians in the besieged Gaza Strip rallied on Friday to mark International Quds Day. Millions of people around the world hold rallies every year to mark this day, which takes place on the last Friday of the holy Muslim month of Ramadan, to support the people of Palestine. Protesters shouted slogans against the Israeli regime and demanded an end to the Israeli occupation. The big event was organized by the Islamic Jihad movement.
Today we mark International Quds Day, while freedom fighters from Gaza, Yemen, Tehran, Lebanon and Syria, as well as in other places around the world, stand united for the sake of Al-Quds.
International Quds Day was declared in 1979 by the founder of the Islamic Revolution in Iran, the late Ayatollah Khomeini, to drum up international solidarity for the Palestinian people. People at the rally expressed their gratitude to Imam Khomeini for his historic initiative.
On International Quds Day, we say to the whole world that we are willing to sacrifice our lives for the sake of Al-Quds. We also want to express our deepest gratitude to the Islamic Republic of Iran and Imam Khomeini for this important occasion in solidarity with Al-Quds.
Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque have a special place in the hearts of millions of Muslims around the world due to its religious status. Extremist Jewish settlers backed by Israeli forces have been violating the sanctity of the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in recent days.
Imam Khomeini's designation of this day is of great importance because it unites all resistance fronts for the sake of supporting Palestine and Al-Quds. These fronts are united today more than ever to help secure the liberation of Al-Quds.
International Quds Day is observed in over 80 countries around the globe.
Observers say the international community has failed to help the Palestinians and has turned a blind eye to the Israeli violations against them for decades. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah held a rally to commemorate International Quds Day. Secretary General of the resistance movement Said Hassan Nasrallah addressed the gathering, stressing that the latest individual operations by Palestinians have once again shown the weakness of the Israeli regime, while proving that the Palestinian people have not forgotten their cause, but have rather become more hopeful in the liberation of their land.
The Palestinians told the Israelis over the past weeks that they cannot occupy Palestine and still enjoy security. The military confrontations have proven to be capable of achieving victories and defeating the enemy, and this path must continue. Liberating Palestine might not need great armies or weapons, but rather martyrdom fighters.
Said Nasrallah also warned the Israelis that any uncalculated move during their military drills in May will lead to a direct retaliation from Hezbollah.
When the Israeli exercises begin, the resistance in Lebanon will be at the highest levels of alert and readiness. We tell the Israeli enemy not to bet on exhaustion or hunger or poverty. Any act of foolishness will be met with an immediate response.
The leader of the resistance in Lebanon once more reiterated the regional strategy that any assault on Al-Quds will lead to a regional war. Palestinians in Lebanon also attended the rally in Beirut and held several gatherings in refugee camps. They also were vocal in asserting that they are with the pro-armed struggle.
We tell our people, the youth of Al-Quds, where 250,000 have gathered to fortify and defend this holy site. They are defending the dignity of the entire nation. Today we are commemorating this day not only in solidarity, but we are commemorating with the sword of Al-Quds. We are the children of the sword. We are the sons of the resistance and the front of the resistance. And with resistance, we shall liberate Al-Quds and defend human dignity.
Despite being away from their homeland, Palestinian refugees said their hearts and minds are with their people.
International Quds Day is seen by many across the globe as a day to denounce Israeli oppression and occupation of Palestinian land. For Palestinians in the diaspora, it is a day to renew their decades-long struggle to return to their homeland. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Another Quds Day, another worldwide cry for the end to Israeli crimes in occupied Palestine. From Iran to Iraq to London, over the weekend, thousands turned up in the British capital to call once more for an end to Israel's crimes against humanity. And on Friday, a bus emblazoned with messages calling on people to join the campaign for a free Palestine. On board were representatives of the Jewish community and clergy who say Zionism has hijacked their faith.
Zionism is raising anti-Semitism over the world. Zionism with the acts by the killings, in the robbery of the land, in the killing of innocent women and children, this raise anti-Semitism over the world. So Zionism doesn't save Jews at all.
As a daughter of people who survived the Holocaust, it's very important that every nation should have learned by that and learned about freedom. And how dare Jews who suffered, how dare they do the same to the Palestinians as what happened to their parents? I think it's absolutely beyond disgusting.
Carol, a Jew in the eighth decade of her life, says she is confident she will see Palestine free in her lifetime.
And this is a sentiment shared here in London and around the world, that the last apartheid on earth is about to end and justice is just around the corner for the Palestinians.
Also passionate about the Palestinian plight are Black Lives Matter activists, who say their cause has historic links to the anti-occupation movement in the occupied Palestinian territories.
I think that one day Palestine will be free, and I think it's important for us to keep up that fight. You know, I remember, and I can only equate it to South Africa. They said it could never happen. They said black people could never be free. Nelson Mandela, the idea of him being a prime minister or president was impossible, and that's what they've said about Palestine. But we are still here, and the thing is, we're not going to stop fighting and campaigning and marching and protesting until they are free.
The annual Quds Day march comes in the wake of repeated attacks on Masjid al-Aqsa and Gaza throughout the holy month of Ramadan. Young and old were being targeted, hundreds were arrested, at least 150 Palestinians were injured and 19 killed. Calls are growing louder every year for the international community to force an end to the occupation, which is not a matter of if, but when. Bianca Rahimi, London.
The Islamic Republic of Iran hosted an event devoted to commemorating Quds Day as part of Moscow's Ramadan tent, an annual charitable event organized by the Russian Council of Muftis and the Iranian Embassy in Moscow. The International Quds Day, a day of solidarity with the Palestinian people, created by Ayatollah Khamenei, the founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
It was a wise decision by Imam Khomeini to designate Quds Day. Using the example of the Palestinians, everyone should think about their own people and the equality of their rights. For me, Al-Quds is a symbol of a struggle for justice. That struggle is led by Iranians who have greatly contributed to the triumph of justice across the world.
I have learned from Palestinians that the struggle for justice is of greater value than religious and political doctrines. Quds Day, designated by Imam Khomeini as a day of solidarity with the Palestinians, teaches us the same thing. Palestine shows the power of faith in justice to resist powerful empires that are armed with modern weapons. Palestinian youths are only armed with stones, and all these people are armed with their faith in God.
The guests of the event told Press TV that Christians are not indifferent to the Judaization of Al-Quds. The Zionist leadership of Israel today determines what Muslims and Christians can and cannot do there, where they are allowed or not allowed, as well as the expulsion of Palestinians from their land causes rage and dissent.
Pro-Palestinian activists say making the International Quds Day is even more important today than when it was first declared in 1979, as the Israeli regime has grown more reckless and violent to the people of Palestine.
Iranian ambassador reminded that the issue of Al-Quds is not a private or personal, but international, as thousands of Palestinians were murdered and hundreds of thousands of refugees were forced to flee their homes since the beginning of the formation of Israel.
After the Camp David Treaty, the Zionist regime meant that the Islamic State would no longer resist and that Zionists would continue to expand their occupation. They suddenly ran into the approach of Imam Khomeini. He announced the Day of Al-Quds mobilized all freedom-loving people who resist oppression against Israel. Muslims and non-Muslims rose up in support of the people of Palestine.
Марина Картунова, Москва.
Thousands of Yemenis took to the streets of Yemen's capital Sana'a to mark the International Quds Day and to voice their support for Palestinians. Senior officials and Palestinian activists were among the protesters.
We went out today to emphasize the centrality of the Palestinian cause and that Quds is the primary cause of Arabs and Muslims, and that the demise of Israel, which constitutes a cancerous gland in the region, is the basis for ending wars and conflicts in the region. The Zionist entity is behind the fragmentation in our region and is also behind the war and siege we're experiencing today against our country. The millions who went out today around the world will be the army that will liberate Palestine, God willing.
Protesters chanted slogans vowing to regain all the occupied lands all over the Arab world, especially Palestinian territories. They said the Israeli entity is only temporary and will end sooner or later.
Quds is a central and fundamental issue in our reality, our culture, and our nation, despite the failure of the Arabs in the past periods. Today, there is a direct and promising trend, and generations have changed from the past. The axis of resistance has become more cohesive, and there is a wide coordination between the axis forces and the Zionist enemy, aware of the danger of these changes.
Every year, Yemenis mark the International Quds Day as they believe that it is one way of expressing their solidarity with their Palestinian brothers. Despite the tragic humanitarian situation in Yemen, people here say it is the responsibility of all Muslims across the world to stand by the Palestinian people in the face of the Israeli aggression until the liberation of the occupied territories. Abdul Latif Loshali, Sana.
In the limelight.
The Persian Gulf National Day, which the Islamic Republic of Iran marks every year on 10th of Iranian month of Ordibehesht, April 30, reminds Iranians and the world of the importance of this strategic waterway. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Kayhan, international staff writer. This article is titled, Persian Gulf Security Warrants No Entry to Israeli Regime. Stay tuned for more. The Persian Gulf National Day, which the Islamic Republic of Iran marks every year on the 10th of the Iranian month of Ordibehesht, April 30, reminds Iranians and the world of the importance of this strategic waterway. Iran has the largest coastline stretching across the entire northern shores of the Persian Gulf, and hence, from time immemorial, the identity of this body of water through which over 25% of the world's current crude oil supplies pass has been Persian. On the southern shores of the Persian Gulf are the coastlines of six Arab states, including Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, Qatar, the UAE, and Oman, while on its east is Iraq's narrow access to international waters. The Persian Gulf covers an area of 251,000 square kilometers and is connected to the Gulf of Oman in the east by the Strait of Hormuz, while its western end is marked by the major river delta of Arvandrud, which carries the waters of the Euphrates and Tigris. The length of the Persian Gulf is 989 kilometers. Its maximum depth is 90 meters, and it contains a rich variety of marine life, including plants and fishes, the largest of which are the dolphins and the sea cows, while occasionally sharks venture into the area. The Persian Gulf and its littoral possess two-thirds of the world's estimated oil reserves. Hence, the area is dominated by petrochemical and related industries. In addition, there are large gas fields in these waters, with Qatar and Iran sharing a giant field across the territorial median line. North Field in the Qatari sector, South Pars Field in the Iranian sector. These factors have increased the importance